Please join me in the serenity prayer.
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight our 40-minute speaker is Dick W. from Oceanside.
Hi, my name is Dick and I'm an alcoholic. I am standing up. A couple of drinks and I'm 6 feet two. You know, it's nice to be up here. I feel really good because I've seen an awful lot of my good old friends here tonight, you know, and it's really nice to see them. Actually, Peg and I used to be members of this group on a while ago, and we were the members for quite a while, and we used to come up here every Friday night, and we love this meeting, but somehow we get lazy and we don't go out on a Friday night that far away. We go to a meeting, but we don't go that far away. Anyway, I want to thank Paul for asking me to speak here tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak in an AA meeting. And when the leader called my name to come up to the podium, I said the same thing tonight as I say every time I speak. And that is, I say, please let me say something that will help somebody here tonight besides myself. I want to welcome everybody here, and especially the newcomers. And if you happen to be one of the newcomers or a fairly new, I hope you don't sit out there and compare yourself with me. I hope you just tell yourself you're not that bad, or I didn't get down that far, I didn't drink that much, or this or that never happened to me. Or for any other reason, because I'll guarantee you right here and now that if you are alcoholic and you leave this hall and continue on with your drinking, all that I talk about here tonight could and probably will eventually happen to you if you drink long enough. You know, alcoholism is a rotten, vicious, cunning, baffling, slow, progressive, sneaky killer disease rated by the American Medical Association as either the third or the fourth greatest killer in all this world. And in time, it's going to strip you of your health and your wealth, and it's going to beat you right down to your knees. It's going to take away from you all that you hold near and dear to your heart. It's going to cause broken bones and broken promises and broken marriages, broken hearts, and a hell of an awful lot of tears and setback in life. So if you are new, please try to sit back and relax and try to get enough out of this meeting to get you back to another meeting. Actually, Peg and I don't come from this part of the country. We come from the Boston area. You can't tell that, though, you know. We moved out here almost 30 years ago, and we love it out here. But I come from a little town, and I just had a movie about the town I come from. The name of it was Town, and that's Charlestown, where I come from. And it was a one-mile square town, and it's got probably 17 or 18 bar rooms in this little town. Most of the people in the town was Irish Catholics. And they had three Catholic churches, St. Francis, St. Margaret's, and St. Mary's. And I went to St. Francis on the top of the hill. I grew up there and had a lot of fun as a young kid growing up there. And then I started to drink. I didn't drink that much. Every now and then, the three or four of us would get a hold of a half a pint or maybe a quarter beer or something, and we'd split it between the four of us. So there really wasn't that much to drink. The most significant amount of beer I had to start off with, I remember one time I was with two other guys, and we got some wine to get us three quarts of Pickwick Ale. Now, Pickwick Ale is one of those, they call it the poor man's whiskey. That's how strong it was. And the first, we went down the alleyway, and the three of us were standing there. And when I opened up that top of the bottle and I started to drink it, I didn't like it. My God, it was the worst thing I ever tasted. God, it was terrible. But I managed to drink a little bit every now and then. But one of the kids I was with, he was going to put his down in the bushes and he was going to go home and have supper with his family. And he was going to come back later to finish off his beer. So me and the other guy stood there and were drinking, and all of a sudden I realized that my bottle was empty. I took the empty bottle and put it down in the bushes, and I took his quart of Pickwick Ale and I drank his quart of Pickwick Ale. And I'm here to tell you that from that point on, I never could get enough. One drink was 1,000 too many, and 1,000 was never enough. And I set out to drink every time I can. Either I was drinking, or I was planning a drunk, or coming off of a drunk. And I lived in a home with three, I had a mother and father and three sisters. And my father never once hit my three sisters, but he beat the hell out of me a lot of times for things that I had done in school, or things that I was supposed to have done. So I was always watching over my shoulder to make sure that he never caught me doing anything. And I remember coming home one night, and he was sitting at the kitchen chair, at the kitchen table, having his supper, and either my eyes were a little glassy or he could smell the booze in my breath, but he got up off of that kitchen chair, and he grabbed me by the back of the neck, and he brought me over to the stove, and he lifted up the cover, and he pointed to the stove. He said, "If I ever catch you drinking again," he said, "I'll stuff your head right down that fire." And he gave me a slap on the back of the head, and he said, "You get to bed, and no supper for you." And I grew up hating this man. I was always looking over my shoulder to make sure he didn't catch me. And the Second World War broke out. Yeah, the Second World War. The Second World War broke out. I asked my father if he would sign the papers so I could join the Navy. And he gave me a big lecture about being at the right age to help around the house. I begged with him and pleaded with him. So finally he agreed. And the next day we went into the Fargo building in Boston, and he signed the papers, and I was off the United States Navy. I didn't go overseas. I was stationed right down in Key West, Florida. I had a lot of good liberties. Believe me, I did. I was assigned to a sheet metal shack. I'd come out with an honorable discharge. I met a girl, and we got married, and I went to school to learn the sheet metal trade. And I graduated with honors in the sheet metal trade. I loved the sheet metal trade. I was in it for 50-some-odd years. Like I say, I graduated, and I set out in life for the sheet metal trade. And in those days, I was probably making somewhere around maybe $100 or $125 a week or something like that. And in those, that was a lot of money in those days, believe me. We didn't have any bills to pay. A lot of times, people would call us up, and they'd say they're going to take a trip to New York. I never once ever had to say to them, we can't go because I don't have the money. We pack a few clothes, and we take a trip up to New York and have a hell of a good time, three or four couples, and we can back to Boston, and maybe we'd get on the Cape a few times in the summertime. And it always seemed like somebody was having a weekend party in Charlestown. A bunch of people would get together and party from Friday night to Sunday afternoon. My name was always in the top of that list of them when they had these parties, because I could go into a room of people, and I could show you card tricks, and I could tell you jokes, and I'd have tears coming out of your eyes. Many times people would say to me, "God damn, Dick, you're a funny guy. Where the hell did you learn all that stuff?" Well, you know, in those days, I was a funny guy. I didn't have a booze problem. I drank in those days because I wanted to drink, not because I had to drink. But as sure as God made green little apples, my drinking started to pick up. I started to get in trouble with some booze and work, taking time off. And I remember one time we were getting ready to go to one of these weekend parties that I told you about. And my wife passed me in the hallway and she said, "You know, you kind of made a fool of yourself last week. And you embarrassed the hell out of me." She said, "Why don't you cut down on your drinking?" And I probably did cut down on my drinking. But like I said, my drinking started to pick up, and it started to miss time from work. I started to get in trouble with work. And finally, I lost the first job I had. I got fired for not being there. They said, "You're a good man, but you're never here. Whenever we need you, you're always off. You're taking off. You're leaving early. You don't come in." So I left that job, and I went to another sheet metal company. And the same thing happened. They called me in the office and told me that they'd have to let me go. And I remember I had no job to go to, and I was washing and waxing floors over in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for $6 a night. And my wife and kids went without a hell of an awful lot of things in life that they should have had because of my drinking. And her and I continued to argue. By this time, we had three little kids growing up. And every time I had an argument with my wife, it was always about me and the booze problem. Whenever we had an argument, my three children were always standing behind her, looking up at me. And I'd be out of the house, and I'd be in the house, and when I'd be out of the house, I'd knock on the door, and I'd ask her, "Could I please come back in again? I ain't going to drink anymore." And 3 or 4 days later, I'd be back out drinking again, getting in trouble. I remember coming home one particular day, and she had a telegram, and it was for a housing project that opened up in the next city over from Charlestown. And it was a brand new housing project, and people never had lived in it before. And they sent us a telegram to be one of the people to move into this brand new housing project. And she said to me, maybe if we move over to the area of East Boston and get away from these drunken bums that you're hanging around here in Charlestown with, maybe if we get over there, things will be better. I said, yeah, maybe they will. We move over there to East Boston, and the very first thing I did was go down to the local tavern and get to know the bartender and establish a little credit with him so I could drink during the week and pay my bar bill at the end of the week. And you know, that became the most important bill of my life, to make sure that my bar bill was paid at the end of the week. And you know, I remember going into the bar room on a Friday after I'd worked somewhere and made some money. And I would say to the bartender, I want to settle up, how much I owe you? And he'd take this little book out and he kind of give me a shrewd look, and he'd look at me kind of funny looking, and he looked down at this book and he'd say, you owe me $37. Now I knew I didn't owe no damn $37. I maybe owed him maybe $18 at the very most. But I paid the $37 because I didn't want to get shut off. Well, the time came when I did get shut off, and I had no credit, and I had no friends, and I lost all my money and no job. My wife wanted me to get out of the house, but I wouldn't leave because I had nowhere to go. And I lived in the top of this street, and as long as I live, I'll never forget this. I lived on the top of the street they call Faywood Avenue. I lived in this apartment house with 12 other families, and not one person in that whole building spoke to me. And I would be walking up the street, and there'd be a couple of the guys who lived in the same apartment house that I did. They would be walking up in front of me. And their kids would see their dads coming up the street. And they'd run down the street, and they'd grab their dads by the hand, and they'd walk up the street together. And when my kids see me coming, they would turn around and run the other way. If I walked into the house, and the kids were jumping off the couch, and the radio was blaring away, the kids would walk around on their tiptoes or sneak out the back door. And my wife would look right across the room at me, and she'd see me coming in, and she'd look me right in the eye. And she'd say to me, why don't you drop dead and get the hell out of here? We don't need you. And I would feel so sorry for myself. I'd slouch down on the couch, and I'd get up off of the couch, and I'd go out and I'd drink some more. And I was in and out of the house, drinking all the time, getting in a little bit of trouble, not enough trouble to go away or nothing like that. And she said to me one day, she said, I'm moving back to Charlestown. At least I got a sister over there, and I have nobody over here, and I don't care where you go. And I tagged right along with her, and we went back over to Charlestown, and I'm sitting in this bar room one afternoon. I don't know if it was a Sunday afternoon or a Tuesday morning. I don't know what day it was. And I'm sitting in this bar room, and I had 30 cents to my name. And in those days, beers were 10 cents a glass. Cigarettes were 20 cents a pack. Now, I couldn't make up my mind if I should buy a package of cigarettes and one beer, or buy three beers and bum cigarettes. And I'm sitting there, and I'm wondering what I'm going to do, and all of a sudden, a couple of my friends walked in. And they had brand new clothing on, they had brand new shoes on, they had money all in their pockets. They're laughing, and they're happy, and gave me a couple of bucks and bought me a few drinks. I asked them, where are you guys getting all this money? What's going on here? They said, we're breaking into places after they close. You want to come along with us? You know, up until this time, I don't never remember stealing any money or anything. But just to get more money to drink on, I went along with these guys. And it didn't take very long, and I had a pocket full of dough. And my wife, in the meantime, had to move into the project because she had no way of paying her rent. Get on welfare. And I had a pocket full of dough, and like a big hero, I walked down and I knocked on her door on 66 Meppa Street is where she lived. I knocked on her door, and she opened the door, and as my wife was standing there, and there's the three children behind her. And I reached into my pocket to give her some of this money, and she said, I wouldn't take 1 cent of that money if I would die, or I would starve to death before. And I make those children go hungry. I wouldn't take 1 cent of that money because I know where it came from. So get the hell out of here and leave me alone. And she slammed the door on my face. That was so many years ago, I don't know exactly what I said to myself, but I probably said something like, to hell with her, that's more money for me to drink on. And that's probably what I did say. And I continued on to break into these places, and I eventually got caught. And I went in front of a judge, and he gave me 5 years and a day. And they put a belt on me and a handcuff me. And they brought me up to this place they call a plant in this prison. They put me in this plant. And the room, the floors were painted maroon and the walls were painted gray. And they had one window over there with bars on it and they had a big steel door over here. And three times a day they'd open up that big steel door and the guards would stand behind in one of the corners and they'd slide the food into me in the bottom of the steel door. And I told myself I'm going to go absolutely crazy. I can't spend 5 years in a day like this. I can't do it. You know, 3 days later, they opened up that great big steel door, and the guard told me, he said, follow me. And they gave me three sets of striped uniform, and they gave me a little book and pair of earphones. They brought me up onto the second tier into this prison. And the little book talked about the parole system, and 3 days later, they put me out into population, and I met a couple of guys from my hometown in Charlestown. And they told me, Dick, have nice visits with your wife if she comes to visit you, because they're going to be watching you. Don't get into a fight. If you get into a fight, you'll never make a day. You'll never make a parole. So don't get into a fight. Go to church on Sunday, because they're going to watch them. They're going to notice all these things. And I did all these things. My wife came to visit me, and I sat in that guard room for 3 hours at a time. And I promised her the world. When I get out of this place, I'm going to straighten out, and I'm never going to drink again. I'm going to get a job, I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to be a good father. But it's awful easy to say things like that when you're in a place where they tell you when to eat, when to sleep, when to go to work. They mock you everywhere you go. You can't say a word. Well, the day came, and they let me go. And I wasn't out very long. I was in this bar room because I didn't see the parole officer around anywhere. I was in this bar room with this guy, and we decided to to hold up a couple of places. So we got a gun. We pulled off two armed robberies, one in the city of Boston and one in New York Square, Times Square. And I got caught in Times Square, and they're going to sentence me to Rikers Island. But every time I went to court, I pleaded not guilty. And finally, they found out there was a warrant for my arrest back in Boston, and I went in front of a judge, and he told me he's going to give me the best break they ever could possibly get. He released me from prison, from New York, and two detectives came up, put the handcuffs on me, and they brought me back to Boston, and I went to trial, and I wound up back in prison again. I don't want to talk too long about prison, but I do want to say that the very last time that I was in prison, they sent me down to this place on a parole violation. They sent me down to this prison, Walpole, Massachusetts, and from Walpole, they transferred me down to Norfolk Prison Colony. Now, Norfolk Prison Colony was the best prison I have ever been in my life. And at the same time, it was the worst prison I've ever been in my life. My wife sent me separation papers. I had no visitors coming in. Nobody wrote me any mail. I had no money. And I walked that quadrangle in that prison every single night, a quarter of a mile round. I walked that quadrangle every single night, and I didn't associate with anyone. And I certainly didn't want anybody to bother with me. And I was the loneliest and most hatefulest guy in that prison. And I couldn't wait so they could release me. Well, the day finally came and they gave me a brand new prison suit and $76 and they set me free. And the first place I headed for was the bar room down there in Nepa Street to see all my friends. Not one of these friends ever took the time to come to visit with me, but I thought these guys were my friends. Somebody wrote me for the $76 and I lost the coat somewhere. And in those days, I don't know what they are now, but in those days, the taverns used to close at 11 o'clock at night. And after they had last call and I walked out into the street, I had nowhere to go. I had no job, no money. Nobody wanted me. No place to sleep. And I didn't know what the hell I was going to do. And I don't know why, but I walked up on the main street of Bunker Hill Street in Charlestown. And I walked up to the top of Bunker Hill Street, and there's St. Francis Church over here, St. Francis Convent over here, and there's the graveyard in back of the church. I went down in the back, and I crawled up into this graveyard. And I fell asleep in this graveyard. You know, and I woke up in that graveyard many, 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 many times after that. And I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be home with my wife and kids. But every time I went down to talk to her and beg with her and plead her to take me back again, her answer was always, screw. Get the hell out of here. We don't need you. You know, and sometimes after I talked to her and she said after me, Instead of walking out onto the street, I climbed those 3 flights of stairs in that project. And I sat on the edge of the roof more than one time. And I wanted to give myself one little push, but I couldn't do it. I'd come down off of that graveyard, and I'd walk up and down the streets in Charlestown. I went in the church, and I knelt on the altar, and I begged God, please help me stop drinking, and I continue on to drink. And I'd see people coming down towards me, and when I'd be walking up the street, and they would see me, and they'd turn around, and they'd walk the other way. I seen my own daughter with about 4 or 5 of her girlfriends coming down the street, on the other side of the street. And I seen her kind of duck in behind the other girlfriend so that she wouldn't have to talk to her drunken father. And I walked up in this graveyard, like I said, many, many times. And I woke up there one time, and there was a fellow by the name of Andy Johnson. Now, Andy Johnson was a guy who came into the prisons in the hospitals, and he would put meetings on. And he talked about the 12-step house over there in Dover Street in Boston. And I walked over to that 12-step house. First of all, I went down to see my Uncle Herb. My Uncle Herb was the only guy in the world who really took interest in me. Every now and then he gave me a bottle of beer, a couple of dollars, and he talked to me about getting sober. If you get yourself sober, I'll get you a job. And he was very kind to me. I went down to visit him, and he gave me a bottle of beer that morning, and I put the bottle of beer down, and I banged it on the counter, and I pointed down to it, and I said, Herb, that's the last drink I'm ever going to have. Oh, that's good, he said. Glad to hear that. That's really good. And I walked over to this 12-step house. And I walked backwards and forwards in front of that place for 7 or 8 minutes. It seemed like every time I was going to say, that's it, I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to ask for some help. And I go to reach that doorknob, and there'll be 2 or 3 guys coming out, or 2 or 3 guys going in. And I'm walking backwards and forwards for, like I said, 7 or 8 minutes. And I didn't have the nerve to go in there. And the things were going through my mind were, as soon as they know about all the beatings I gave my wife and the kids that I robbed, the kids' big piggy banks that I robbed, the rent money that I had stolen, the making the cashing in, the cornering, the cashing in all the life insurance, and all the money, all the punching and yelling and screaming I did to her, the knives that I thrown at her, the televisions that I throw the ashtrays through, the bedroom sets that I demolished, the refrigerator that I tipped over in the kitchen floor, the yelling and the screaming, the time I had her right off the floor by the neck, almost choked her to death. And I said, ah, shit, they're not like me anyway, the hell with them. And I turned around to walk away from the 12-step house. And that's when the grace of God entered my life for the first time. Seemed there was 2 guys who drove up to right in front of the place, and I'm getting ready to walk away, and it was a narrow street. So the driver closed the door of his car like that, and he walked out and he put his hand out and he said, hi, kid. My name is Bob. What do you say we go and have a cup of coffee? And I says, okay. So we went in, we sat down, 2 other guys, me and two other guys, we sat down at this round table, and they were telling me things I already done. Things that I thought that I was the only person in this whole world. No one has ever done these things. And boy, it made me feel good to know there was another person in this life like myself. I stuck around that 12-step house for the next 2 or 3 days. Met a lot of people. Finally, a couple of guys from the Charlestown group, my hometown, walked into the 12-step house, and I knew both these guys. I worked on the dock with them, but I had no idea they were in the program. I went over to the Charlestown, I joined the Charlestown group in the Sunday night meeting. And I got active with the Sunday night meeting. And I took commitments. I asked this guy, Jocko, to be my sponsor. And he said to me one time, he said, you be on in front of the drugstore each and every night, and I want no excuses. You better be there. I may not be there, but you better be there. I'm going to go to a meeting every single night. And I was down in front of the drugstore every night. And I didn't want to tell him all my problems. They were my problems. Why else should I have to tell him? I didn't want to go to this meeting because I heard the same speaker before. Why should I have to go there and listen to him again? I didn't want to do this. I didn't want to do that. But I did them. And we're walking down the street one day, and I think I was sober 37 days at the time. And he says to me, Are you asking for help? I said, what do you mean I'm asking for help? He said, you ask for help from the God, your God, to help you to stay sober. I said, why are you? He's a big, tall guy. I said, why are you? Everybody's taller than me. I said, no, I don't. He said, well, I want you to start asking for help. By this time, I had a room in the YMCA in Charlestown. And I was on the 9th floor. I'm in this room all by myself. And before I could get down on my knees to say my prayers and ask for help, I looked around to make sure there was nobody in the room. And I asked for help that particular night, and I've been asking help every night ever since. I spoke for the first time in my life down in Central Falls, Rhode Island. That's about 60 miles outside of Boston. A guy by the name of Tommy D came in and he opened up the meeting. And the first person he called was me. And when I got up at the podium to say something, I swear to Christ, if anybody was to say to me real quick, what's your name? I wouldn't have been able to tell him. I wouldn't even have known. I couldn't stop shaking, and I thought I was going to go blind. I think I talked for about 5 minutes, and it sounded like 5 hours. It seemed like 5 hours. But you know, I'll never forget what I had said to myself as I was walking back to my seat. I said, well, you finally did it. You finally admitted some of the things have been killing you and tearing you apart and eating you up inside. Up until that time, I was going to tell absolutely no one nothing. But you know, I happened to leave a little bit out that night. And I'm leaving a little bit out every night ever since. And I'm very proud to stand here and tell you that last January the 3rd, I celebrated 50 years of sobriety. Yeah. I'm not very proud to stand here and tell you about all the things I did. And no other alcoholic is very proud to say the things that he did, that he said. The only reason I or anybody else get at the podium and say the things that they do say is only in hopes that they may help another alcoholic. My Uncle Herbert got me a job. My Uncle Herbert got me a job in the sheet metal company. And I managed to save $2,600. And a friend of mine who was involved in a sheet metal work matched my $2,600. We went over to this brand new bank called Barclay Bank in Brighton, Massachusetts. That's kind of hard to say real fast. So we asked them for a $50,000 loan so we could start a sheet metal company. And the guy was, I don't know what to say to you guys. He says, I don't know. I'll have to take it in front of the board and see what happens. We'll get in touch with you. And about a week and a half later, they call me up and says, we got some papers for you to sign. So me and my partner went in, we signed some papers, and we started in the sheet metal business. And we had a few pieces of equipment when they gave us the money. And I would work, we would work sometimes 60, 70, 75 hours a week. And sometimes I'd go home with $15 pay after all that time. Everybody else came first. We had to pay off all the vendors. Everybody had to be paid. And then whatever was left, then me and my partner would split. But things started to get better as time went on. We got so good that we were doing an awful lot of work with General Electric up there in Utica, New York. And so we decided to hire one guy part-time. So we hired this one guy part-time, and everything worked out so good that we told him he can work full-time. And you know something? Before I realized that we had two, and then three, and then four, and then five, and then six, I had 26 guys working for me. We had to buy more sheet metal equipment. 26 people. I had a full-time guy in the office buying stuff. A buyer, and we had. Purchasing agent. And things were great. We made an awful lot of money in that business. After 20 years, I sold it, and Peg and I moved out here to California, and we love it out here. We do an awful lot of traveling. We go to different places, and actually, we gamble too much, but we go gambling all the time. We love it, but we do an awful lot of things together, you know. I know I forgot an awful lot of things I want to tell you, but I do want to tell you this. In all my wildest dreams, it's not as good as my life is today. And it's all because of people like yourself sitting in the halls of AA. I hope to God I never, ever get to the point in my sobriety where I think I got all the answers and I don't have to ask any more questions. I don't have to go to any more AA meetings. And in the years that I have been sober, I've seen a hell of an awful lot of people in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some young and some old. I particularly don't care if you're a young person and you drank for six months, or an older person and you drank for 60 years. AA will work for anyone, anytime, any place, anywhere, under any conditions, for anyone who wants it, and not one second longer. I no longer land that graveyard and spit it to heaven and pray to the devil. I ask the God of my understanding to help me, a drunk, to stay away from that very first drink. I try to get to a meeting at night time if it's at all possible. And I'm certainly grateful enough at the end of the day to thank my God for another day of sobriety. You know, this is the first time I've spoken in over a year, almost a year and a half. I went in the hospital for a simple operation, and it wound up to being a very, very bad operation. I spent 5 days in the intensive care and 3 months and 10 days in a room in the hospital. My legs swelled up about four times the size, and my foot swelled up. I got a couple of blood clots, and I was in this room all by myself, and there's four beds in this room. I said to the doctor one time, I says, "How come, if there's four beds in here, how come I'm the only one in this room?" He said, "Well, you have an infection." I said, "What do you mean? A staph infection?" He said, "Yeah." So I had staph infection. I almost died. The second time, my stomach busted open. I had to reoperate on it. And the operation took 3.5 hours on the right side. And they stopped the operation. They had to get in a specialist in to finish the operation. And the next morning, I'm laying in my bed, and the doctor who came in with another doctor, and he said, "Mr. Wheeler, I want to introduce you to the guy who probably saved your life." And that was the other doctor who finished the operation. I'm a very, very lucky guy. I missed AA. I didn't go to AA for 3 months. I laid in that bed, and I was a bed patient. They wouldn't let me out of bed. I don't know why I tore it up, because I just started. This is the very first place I spoke in over a year and a half. I've been asked to speak many, many places, and I turned them all down. I was going to went to Florida, Alabama, Ohio, Georgia. Peggy and I had a chance to get on to Vegas and speak. I told them, "No, make it mad." she wanted to go down there. I'm getting close to wrapping up what I'm going to say, but I just want to say to anybody new here, we have the books. We have the literature. We have the friendly handshakes. We got the people. We got the meetings. All you need is a desire. A desire to do something about your booze problem. Never mind the guy or the gal sitting in front of you and back of you and next to you. Look over your own record. Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? Do you really want to do something with the rest of your life? My God, all the help that you'll ever need, you're going to find right here in the halls of AA. It's no shame to be an alcoholic. The only shame is that once you know there's a place that you can come to seek out the help you need, and you don't avail yourself of it. That is the only shame. So if you are new, please, don't give up. Read the literature. Take commitment. Get involved with us. Do whatever you have to. It's well worth it, believe me. And for the guy or the gal who may be here and has been in and out of the program for a few times, if you are that person and you're here tonight, God love you. I'm glad to see you here. But please remember that better people than some of us will ever be have gone through the doors of AA, and some will never return. So if you're that person, please don't take another chance out there. You may not ever get back. And in closing, I do want to say to the guy or the gal who has been around this program for a few 24 hours, my God, may you never, ever, 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 ever forget the condition that you were in when you first arrived through the doors of AA. Reach your hand out to that new person. Welcome him or her back. Hey, who knows? That could be the one thing that will bring somebody back to another meeting. God bless you all.